You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Deputy Director at the Quincy Institute, historian Stephen Wertheim, on Biden's foreign policy choices for the future. Meanwhile, Bill Barr abandons the good ship SS Republican delusion, but not after laying a booby trap for Joe Biden. COVID deaths topped 2,500 in the U.S. yesterday as states desperately search for medical workers. Meanwhile, Trump contemplating preemptive pardons for his children and his favorite lawyer. And apparently, the DOJ was investigating a possible bribery for pardon scheme. UK authorizes a COVID vaccine, and Trump is grumpy because he doesn't understand the second mover advantage. McConnell fighting a COVID relief compromise as a new report shows how skewed the Paycheck Protection Program was in favor of large corporations. Trump threatens the defense authorization signing unless Congress repeals Section 230 protection for internet platforms. And your chocolate is about to get a lot more bitter. It's Nestle and Cargill accused in the Supreme Court of the United States of aiding and abetting child slave labor, trying to wriggle out of it. And remember those attacks on Ilhan Omar's AIPAC comments? Barack Obama says nearly the same thing in his book, and crickets. Lastly, young Republicans plan their indoor gala, New York City, featuring Sarah Palin this week. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We got a lot to talk about. Joining me today, as almost every day these days, Emma Vigeland. Emma, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well today. I thought of a nickname for Rudy Giuliani while you were like a Trump nickname if he was on the other side. I think you'd call him Sweaty Giuliani.
Sweaty Giuliani.
Right?
Sweaty Rudy.
That's all I can say.
Sweaty Rudy, folks.
Sweaty Rudy. Rudy's very sweaty.
Dripping down his face, looking disgusting.
In this instance, he's offering him a preemptive pardon, perhaps. At least contemplating it, and for his kids, no word about Tiffany or Barron. I think it's just the ones that have been in close proximity to him, which is not to say that Tiffany or Barron have not been in close proximity, although I think there's reason to believe that they have not been in close proximity.
Certainly less frequently.
Without doubt. And Rudy Giuliani obviously is being investigated by New York State officials and perhaps the Southern District of New York. We will get to more of that later. There's a lot of news to talk about, not the least of which Bill Barr announcing yesterday that there is no, not only has the DOJ found no evidence of any voter fraud, nor has, according to him, the Department of Homeland Security, which, of course, we know that the at least one official was fired for coming out and saying at least the area in which he dealt with cybersecurity, there was no evidence of any type of interference from outside governments. Bill Barr did, however, appoint Dunham, the prosecutor who he had assigned back in 2019. It's sort of amazing when you think about it how long. In fact, Marcy Wheeler did the numbers. The investigation into the investigators, as they would call it back in the day, has actually required more personnel days, has been longer than the actual investigation into Donald Trump.
And what did she say? 70% longer?
So yeah, almost like 2/3 longer, 66%, something to that effect. And it's ongoing. And Bill Barr has officially made Dunham a special prosecutor. People are sort of baffled by this. It's unclear exactly why, but it's presumably to give him more independence and make it harder for whoever Joe Biden's attorney general is to end the investigation. Now, remember, there was a lot of pressure on Dunham, apparently, to come up with a result before the election. Donald Trump was very upset about that. He's still talking about how he's upset about that there was no interim report released. We should also remind you that Dunham's longtime lieutenant, he is the U.S. attorney in Connecticut, his longtime lieutenant, a woman who had worked with him, I think, for over a decade, resigned sometime in the fall, if I recall correctly, because she felt there was so much pressure.
Right. And these are all of those conspiracy theories about the FBI agents texting about Flynn and all of that. And the reason that Barr is doing this, even as he goes against Trump's wishes on the election, is that he's affording the privileges to Durham or Dunham. Which one is it?
Durham.
Durham.
That, did I say Dunham? Sorry.
I don't know. I can't keep track. That basically Robert Mueller had. So you get one special counsel, you get another. I mean, we're going to keep going back and forth and back and forth on this if it's this politicized going forward.
Well, it's being analyzed as a sop to Donald Trump. But I also just think that Bill Barr is a movement conservative. He is a movement Republican, as it were. And anything they can do to obstruct and harm a Biden administration, they will do. This is the era that we're living in. Frankly, I would argue that in terms of what Republicans have been doing, this is an era we've been in for at least 20 years,
yep,
probably closer to 25. It is only Donald Trump that I think has made it quite clear to the conventional wisdom, as it were. It does feel like the Democratic leadership still has not picked up on this, but we will see. You know, I keep hoping that the platitudes of like, we can get along, we're going to unify the country, are simply platitudes. But there, you know, the idea that this is possible with this Republican Party is beyond absurd. It's dangerous. And we have seen its danger. We saw it, in things like Barack Obama attempting to do a grand bargain and cut Social Security. We saw it in the context of Merrick Garland, who was simply a poor pick based upon the politics and the reality of whether Mitch McConnell was going to give any of Obama's nominees a hearing. I mean, we could go on and on.
We're seeing it now. Right now, McConnell is rejecting this bipartisan stimulus bill, which has the liability shield that he wants, and saying that he's not going to consider it. And it doesn't have stimulus checks. It just has $300 of unemployment as opposed to $600, which the Democrats initially wanting, which people have been getting. So it's already a conservative bill, and he's already rejecting it.
Well, yes. I mean, he's just not interested in that at all. And we will talk more in the coming days about what's happening in the House and the reporting that I'm seeing that Nancy Pelosi may be looking for an actual budget bill as opposed to a continuing resolution. Quickly, a continuing resolution essentially is a punt. It says we will keep all the funding at this level and we will deal with it in 2 or 3 months, but we've got a deadline coming up, and that is December 11th, where the government will shut down unless there's a continuing resolution or a new budget bill. And the idea that you would pursue a new budget bill is leaving a lot of people scratching their heads, because a continuing resolution gets you into January, deep into January, where you have an incoming Democratic president and the possibility, maybe unlikely, but the possibility of a democratically controlled Senate. And there may be one bite at the apple to do anything. And that is all going to be done through reconciliation. So if you lock yourself into a budget deal with Mitch McConnell now, while the Republicans have power, it is necessarily going to be less than what you want in terms of your priorities, one that you might be able to pass in January when you have a Democratic Senate. If you don't get that Democratic Senate, you still have a Democratic president, and you're simply in the same position you are now, except either way, the Republicans are going to have a little bit less of a margin in the Senate. So it is bewildering, and it is consistent with what we've seen with House leadership, which is we're not going to do anything proactive. We're not going to legislate. We're not going to attempt to exercise any leverage when we can get it. Remember, you know, you talked about this bill, this compromise bill by the Gang of Four or Gang of Eight. We haven't quite established who.
Gang of Attention Seekers.
Indeed. But they have only $160 billion for states and cities. Go back to April after the second tranche of the PPP was passed. Nancy Pelosi attacking critics who said, hey, you just gave away all your leverage. How are you going to get money for states and cities? She said, don't worry, we will get it. That was 7, now 8 months ago. And we're not getting it. And they need it bad. But we got to take a break and talk a little bit about our sponsors today. And then when we return, we will be talking to Stephen Wertheim. Oh, this is great. This is, I don't know if you're aware of Blinkist, Emma, but...
I've heard of it, yes.
Okay. I am sure if you're like me, because I know you're busy, there's books out there, maybe even podcasts. You're like, I'm sort of interested in it, but I'm not prepared to sit down and read the whole thing. Well, Blinkist is for anyone who cares about learning but doesn't have a lot of time. It takes the key ideas and insights from over 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 categories. It gathers them together in 15-minute text or audio explainers. They call them Blinks.
Wow.
Yes. You use Blinks, you get into a topic quickly. And Blinkist at this point has even teamed up with popular podcast creators. Still waiting for a phone call. To Blink those for you too, so you can get to the heart of a podcast episode fast. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge in 27 nonfiction categories like self-improvement, management, mindfulness, more. For me, I use it. There's two things. One, I want to learn to, get along with people better. And so I read the books about how to be more, charming or how to, make friends.
I think
I'm not going to read the
prose. Perfectly charming already. Maybe it's because of Blinkist.
Maybe part of it. And so, but I don't want to read all the, in between stuff. Like, I don't want to hear the anecdotes about,
right.
Bill was
great
always
shots
thought,
in
yeah.
the vein
I just, exactly.
Of knowledge, right.
Exactly. I just want the key takeaways. I did that with the Tim Ferriss books. I know I always talk about that, but, the 80-20 stuff. I mean, that's where I learned like some of these like basic principles. Because I'm not a business person. I don't know if you've picked up on that. But you can dive into these type of books. And then there are books like where I feel like I should know about that book, but I don't really want to read it. Blowout by Rachel Maddow. Like I felt like that's a book I should probably be aware of, but I don't know if I got the time to read the whole thing. So 15 minutes, I can do that.
Boom.
Boom. Exactly. Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. That made me upset a little bit because I don't sleep, but I wanted to get to a quick boom. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority report. You start your 7-day free trial. You get 25% off of Blinkist premium membership. So you go to Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/majority report. You get 25% off and a 7-day free trial, Blinkist.com/majority report. And this I am loving because I have made the determination that I was going to buy clothing. I'm going to go outside and I'm going to try and socialize outside. I've been reading about this, how like the Nordic countries do, right? They're in coronavirus. Right. Well,
my people.
Are those your people? Well, then you probably already know this.
Norwegian.
Wool. Yeah. Right? That's the key.
There you go.
Well, backcountry.com is the place to go if you want to be outside this winter.
Nice.
When you shop at backcountry.com, you can pick up the phone. You talk gear with an actual former Olympian. I don't know if you know about this. First of all, it was founded by a former Olympic skier. Backcountry.com is the best place for outdoor gear and apparel. They have Patagonia, they have Yeti, they have Santa Cruz bicycles. Backcountry.com has thousands of your favorite brands and products for every outdoor adventure. It's nuts. I have gone down a wormhole on their site. Yes. Well, I don't know if you know this, but I board and I'm teaching my kids to board. So I bought Saul for Hanukkah. Hopefully he's not listening to the show. He probably is not. A hover cover.
For his board?
Yeah. Do you know what that is?
No, I don't, because I snowboarded a little. I mostly ski, though.
It's like, it's some type of like neoprene-ish type of cover you put on the board so he can practice indoors.
That's so cool.
And he's going to love it. And then I got myself some, I can't even pronounce this, Fjall Rovan long johns. They're obviously like...
Keep you warm?
Yes.
Nice.
They're long johns. They're wool. I got some knee pads because I'm an old guy and I worry about when I fall when I'm boarding. They had some Sam Hill knee pads. And now I'm in the middle of trying to figure out which vest I'm going to get because people know I'm a vest
guy. Do they have those wrist guards? I bet they do.
They have the wrist guards.
I broke my wrist snowboarding, so yes. That's why I stopped.
I get it with the internal gloves too. No, they have padded for your butts. They have everything.
Nice.
Everything you could ever imagine. And they've got about 9 million versions of a vest that I'm looking at. Not like a sweater vest, but it really is awesome. And it's like one of those places you would love to go and walk through. And obviously right now I'm not as interested in doing that, but it's like a virtual one.
Cool.
Go to backcountry.com/majority. Enter the promo code majority to get 15% off your first full price purchase. Some exclusions apply. Go right now, get 15% off at backcountry.com/majority. Enter the promo code majority, backcountry.com/majority. Don't forget to enter the code majority, folks. All right, I'd like to welcome to the show, returning to the show. We had him on actually fairly recently, Stephen Wertheim. He is a historian and the deputy director of the Quincy Institute. Stephen, welcome.
Hey, good to be back.
I'm still reeling from our talk about your book about the UN, and it has really, honestly, it's been something I've been thinking about quite a bit in terms of the implications of the UN in the world and our role in it. And you have written a piece with Benjamin Friedman. Say No Joe in Foreign Policy, and it is basically arguing that we should not be going back to the status quo. I want to talk to you about some of his appointments so far and who you anticipate may be future appointments in this field. But let's start with what Joe Biden, what he ran on, and then let's go from there.
Right. So on the one hand, Biden ran on something like a restoration. I mean, at times his rhetoric could get almost explicitly conservative in the sense of let's go back to the status quo before Trump. He had a piece in Foreign Affairs magazine that came out toward the beginning of this year. Where implicitly he grouped all presidents prior to Trump since 1945, so that would include George W. Bush,
right,
as upholders of the liberal international order, U.S. leadership, etc. So there's been that element. And you see that element just in the past several days when he's saying America's back, and he's saying that to heads of state, heads of government around the world. On the other hand, I think we need to distinguish Joe Biden from candidates like Hillary Clinton, you know, true believers in U.S. military intervention. I don't think Joe Biden is quite the same, right? Both of those figures have been firmly within the mainstream. Joe Biden has always been there himself. And of course, he supported the Iraq war and, to my mind, has never given a great explanation about why he did that, what he learned from it, etc. But he at least seems to understand where America is in the world right now and what Democratic voters and just voters in general, the American people, are thinking about their foreign policy. So since the war on terror started to go obviously haywire, he has been more cautious from within the mainstream about U.S. military operations, including opposing the surge in Afghanistan, from within the Obama administration, a lonely voice taking that point of view. And so he did in the campaign talk about bringing an end to the forever war. He did promise to essentially break from the late Obama policy of supporting the Saudi-led coalition in its war in Yemen, said he would end U.S. support, even called Saudi Arabia a pariah on the Democratic debate stage. So he's not where I'd like him to be exactly on a whole range of issues, but I think it gives us something to work with.
Okay, so there's and it's interesting the pieces say no, Joe, because there is a quality of like we need to maybe strip down some stuff, as it were, before we build up and become proactive in some way in the way that we engage the world. And we seem to have, if I understand you correctly, there's two sort of constructions here. One is America's place in the world in terms of, like you say, the liberal establishment order, which was, and it's arguable, I think, as to when this started to really genuinely erode. I would argue that it did earlier than I think a lot of people are suggesting, but which had basically U.S. hegemony in one form or another around the world. I mean, we have 800 approximately, maybe 750 bases around the world. At least since the fall of the Soviet Union, we have perceived ourselves, if not others, having perceived us as a hyperpower. So that's, and then that's one sort of, I guess, rubric. And then the other is how much the military and intervention you use to maintain that status. Let's take the first one first, because it seems to me that, and to be fair, you know, this was my assessment 4 years ago. It has not changed. That if I'm other countries in the world and I'm looking at America, like, you know, to me, Sam Cedar, I'm looking at America maybe, and I'm saying, cause, you know, I'm a doe-eyed optimist saying like, Donald Trump is just, you know, an anomaly. It's just a once-off fluke and that's it. And, we're gonna fix everything. We're not gonna go back to that. But if I'm from a different country, I'm looking at this and I'm going like, if they can go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump, why would a rational person like me from a different country, think that they can't go to, you know, Donald Trump Jr. after Joe Biden? I mean, we're an unstable country. Yeah. And there, you know, it's like all you need to do. I don't know. I just remember like one anecdote where someone said, like, you know, they were waiting on someone to pick them up and they didn't show after 10 minutes. And the people showed, they said, why'd you leave after 10 minutes? It's like, well, once you didn't show up at the time that you said you were going to, like, all bets are off as far as I'm concerned. Aren't we in that type of situation?
Why do we think Donald Trump is as bad as it can get? I mean,
Tom,
this
Cotton's
is a failure of imagination.
In 2024, you know, that could be a real life fascist if he was able to get past the Republican primary.
But the point being is that we're swinging between, like, the American public has basically said, we're not interested in that type of continuity that other people might be looking to us for.
That's right. And then if we go back before Obama, you have George W. Bush. Okay. So I do think that many other people around the world, other countries around the world, have a longer memory than some people who seem to have an interest in having a short memory. In the town behind me, Washington. And so I think, you know, we can say America's back and so forth, but it's going to be about results. It's going to be about, can the United States actually get a hold of its own conduct at home and abroad? That's the thing that will matter most, I think, both in the next 4 years and over the long term. And you've hit on such a crucial question. And this one is something that I'm hoping that the people around Biden are concerned with and capable of taking seriously. How comfortable are we? I mean, let's imagine that, you know, the Biden team can implement as intelligent and nuanced an American foreign policy as it would like in the next 4 years, maybe in the next 8 years. What does it then mean to hand over the world's largest coercive apparatus to the next Donald Trump or worse? I mean, it didn't go that well under more responsible presidents.
Right.
Well, just then I have a question then when you say, you know, looking forward, where we go from here. You mentioned ending the genocide in Yemen and the Saudi-led coalition there that the United States is funding. And obviously, Biden has signaled that he wants to reenter the Iran nuclear deal, even though there's been immense damage done in the past week with Israel killing their top scientists. So what do you foresee the Iran deal being able to be successfully reimplemented? And then also, what hope is there for other similarly positive coalition building moves by the Biden camp?
The president-elect came out with some nice statements just this morning in the New York Times in conversation with Tom Friedman, of all people, saying essentially that he wanted to have a clean reentry into the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran. In other words, he seemed to be resisting the impulse to use Trump's completely inappropriate sanctions and punishment of Iran for complying with the deal as leverage to try to get a quote unquote better deal. So that's very positive. Let's hope he does that. But it's going to be difficult. As you mentioned, the damage, some damage has been done quite a bit, and we don't know what will happen between now and Biden's inauguration. And so whether Iran is at this point willing to come back into compliance, given that Biden himself for 4 years, for 8 years, may be willing, but what's happened has happened, and what may be happening in the future has to be taken into consideration. That's an open question. What I hope the Biden camp will realize is that the old nuclear deal was living on borrowed time in our own political system. And so we've actually got to go bigger, bolder, if we're going to achieve the result that some were hoping for. I mean, we don't just need to have a nuclear agreement with Iran. We need to systematically pursue a policy of disentangling the United States from the political and military conflicts in the region. Doesn't suit our interest. Sure hasn't worked out very well for people across the Middle East, even if it works out well for certain governments, which are unsavory, and poorly for other governments, which are unsavory. And so to take the Iran issue, you know, step one, in my view, is reentering the JCPOA. You know, that we should be heading toward a course of normalizing relations with Iran, in addition to undoing our over-identification of our own interests with another set of pretty bad actors in the region, Saudi Arabia, whom Biden called a pariah, UAE, Egypt, Israel.
All right, I want to circle back to that, because those are one of the 5 points in your piece. But I just want to stay on that broader question for a moment, which is, if we cannot, I mean, and I guess this is the question I have: if the perception of us as an unstable partner long term is accurate in terms of these, from the perspective of the world, broadly speaking, right? I mean, both regardless of whether we perceive them as allies or competitors or whatever, just, you know, there was a consistency to American foreign policy, for better, for worse, I would argue, in some instances, maybe a little bit worse. But nevertheless, there was this notion of, we project our power, we're the hyperpower, we have this hegemony. Is there a sense, is there an ability to reckon with that within the Biden administration, which says, like, hey, you know what? Maybe we're not going to be the hyperpower. Maybe the it is in our best interest to simply be, you know, one of four, one of five, or, you know, that, I mean, because it seems to me that we're still living under the Project for a New American Century idea of we keep these low level conflicts going on around the world and keep everybody busy so nobody can amass enough power to compete with us. And that seems to be over. Like, what is the new project for this century? And is it maybe not going to be an American one?
I think that the senior advisors around Biden recognize that the so-called unipolar moment that the United States enjoyed at the end of the 1990s was just that. It's a moment and it's past. And actually, the Trump administration has recognized the same thing in its national security strategy. The problem is that, you know, this could lead you in broadly one or two directions. You can say, okay, the United States, you know, didn't even play its incredibly favorably hand well in the most propitious circumstances imaginable. Why should we think it's going to get better going forward? Let's recalculate what threats we face, what our interests are, and judiciously pull back our military force around the world. That's basically what I'm for. But what the Trump administration, the Pentagon in particular, has done is say, oh, this is a problem. And now we need to get tougher. Now that we face a world with great power competitors, near peer competitors, Russia and China, we didn't expect them to rise. And now they're, you know, doing bad things. And so now we've got to focus on them, even as we continue to not be able to wind down our own wars in the Middle East and elsewhere. And, you know, I think that there's actually mainstream bipartisan agreement on that score. And that's troubling. And so I worry that some of the senior people around Biden basically are going to continue this notion of great power competition to orient the United States, which can provide an argument for getting out of the Middle East in order to focus on China in particular. But I think that's an attempt to cling to as much military dominance as possible in conditions that have obviously changed internationally and domestically. I don't think that would be sufficient to bring about the change that we need.
That's basically the first point of five that you make in the foreign policy piece, which is the Biden administration should not pursue global military dominance. I don't know if that's if. So let's move on to point two, because I want to maybe circle back into that, because the question of China and relative, like, you know, what global military dominance means in an era where China is at least perceived to be ascendant. You say the second thing is the Biden administration must deliver on its promise to end the forever wars. You touched on that. That's Afghanistan. Where else do we need to pull back? I mean, Afghanistan, we have now, you know, it's interesting. Trump tried to take off the table, I guess, half our forces there, which would be about 2,500, if I'm not mistaken. And there was, you know, broad pushback on this, in part because it's Trump, or ostensibly because it was Trump, but maybe because of other reasons. Where else do we need to disengage? And what does that disengagement look like? I mean, do we just leave Afghanistan? What does that say to our NATO allies? Although we'll get to NATO is another question as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got a forever war framework via the war on terror that spans across a good portion of the globe, the greater Middle East, North Africa, Afghanistan included in there. The U.S. has ground troops, not just in Afghanistan, but also in Iraq, still Syria, and Somalia. And I think the Biden administration, not just to secure our interests and protect our people, but also to restore a modicum of credibility with the American people, should bring those conflicts to a close in a clear way, over the course of its 4 years. It really would not be a good thing if the next candidate can run saying, you know, Joe Biden has prosecuted the forever war still, you know, and there's just overwhelming support. About three quarters of the American public, which doesn't agree on very much, agrees that U.S. troops should come home from Afghanistan and Iraq. That's just an overwhelming number. So I think to restore some health to our own democracy, and by the way, not create the sense of keep feeding the sense of existential fear that, you know, we have enemies out there that want to kill us, and that's why we've got to kill them. This is incredibly important to bring those conflicts to a close. And it should be done responsibly. But in the case of Afghanistan, the United States has made an agreement with the Taliban, and U.S. troops are supposed to fully come home at the end of April. I actually think that if Trump had been able to bring U.S. troops fully home from Afghanistan, it would have done Biden a favor and avoided Biden having to make now some difficult decisions. But, you know, it's just unimaginable to me how the United States now, with a very small capacity, is fundamentally going to change the balance of power on the ground in Afghanistan.
Right.
We just cannot expect that we're going to lose a war, fight a war for 20 years, not be successful in achieving our grandiose goals, and then refuse to leave until conditions are ideal on the ground. They're not going to be ideal. You know, it was the right thing to end the war in Vietnam. It did lead to the North's takeover of Vietnam. But, you know, we have to be able to live with the consequences and get what we need. And what we need is to make sure that Afghanistan does not become a haven from which the United States is targeted by terrorists. And that's something, you know, we should evaluate just as we evaluate threats from terrorism elsewhere, without continuing to be a participant in the violence in Afghanistan.
Whoa. I mean, I've forgotten now. Like, what was ostensibly our mission in Afghanistan? I mean, I remember, you know, when bin Laden was in Tora Bora and we were surrounded him and then let him go, essentially, because we had to put people into Iraq. But what was the... And I remember there was a brief moment where people were talking about women's rights in Afghanistan and, you know, putting in a democratically elected government there that is going to be in charge of not just Kabul, but everywhere. But we didn't put any resources into that country beyond our military, it seems to me. Like, I don't remember the big project to build all the roads
or build schools
or schools and, yeah. or the, you know, I think at one point we were painting them. I don't like that ended, it seems to me, 15 years ago. And we've just been there, maybe keeping the Taliban from taking over a certain part of the country at any given point. I mean, is that basically what the mission has been? And that doesn't seem to be doing, like you say, I guess it doesn't seem to be doing anything.
Well, the release of the Afghanistan papers last year revealed just how skeptical most senior officials and military leaders have been that the United States could achieve its objective in Afghanistan almost from the beginning. I mean, the initial objective is actually something I support. Look, the United States was attacked on 9/11. The enemy was Al-Qaeda. You know, the United States then set out to decimate Al-Qaeda and also punish the Taliban government for harboring Al-Qaeda. That makes sense. That goal was quickly achieved. Unfortunately, we did not get the leader of Al-Qaeda, bin Laden. But nevertheless, Al-Qaeda was hurt badly. It was quickly achieved. And so instead of saying, okay, you know, if we don't pull back now, we'll never have a coherent reason to pull back, we continued and expanded the mission to nation building, making Afghanistan, you know, exactly who believed that we were going to turn Afghanistan into a liberal democracy is an interesting question. And when those beliefs waxed and waned, but we've actually, you know, made considerable efforts. It's not exactly for want of trying. The Obama administration implemented a major surge of troops in Afghanistan and caught bin Laden. So there was another off ramp to say, hey, we have achieved our mission. If we don't stop this now, when is it going to end? But unfortunately, that off-ramp was not taken. And so here we are with a war that basically nobody can defend. I mean, the Taliban keeps gaining ground. Nobody is seriously proposing in Washington to come up with a creative, you know, strategy backed by significant new resources to really change the equation. We're afraid to leave.
How much do we need Congress to act in this instance? Like, I mean, if they revoke the AMF could they end this, or is it just a question of like our government is structured in such a way that the president has so much more ability to impact foreign policy, even without, broad statutory authority, that there's a much better chance of, you know, because you don't have as many different political, influences for the president to simply make a decision and do this.
You're right that the president has broad discretion. And if the president truly wants to order a withdrawal, the president can certainly do that, which is important to keep in mind in the case of Trump, despite all the rhetoric about withdrawals. When those withdrawals don't happen, it bespeaks a lack of will on the part of the president.
He's saying we're going to withdraw multiple times throughout his presidency, and there's always some back channel which gets them out of it.
That's right. But Congress can absolutely step up always and do its job. I mean, it's in the Constitution. Congress is supposed to declare war. Now, we haven't declared war since World War II, but we do have an authorization for the use of force from 2001, which the president is still using. Congress ought to repeal that and replace it with a much more limited authorization that specifies the location, specifies the enemy, and has sunset provisions. So Congress has to face this question and do their job again and again. Plus, Congress does ultimately control the purse strings.
Right. All right. Well, you also argue that number three is to stop policing the Middle East, which I think is, you know, we've touched on. To say that our policing of the Middle East has been a function of our security is sort of a second order thing. It's more about maintaining our hegemony, which, you know, arguably some people say we need for our security. I don't know. I mean, there's seems to me like, you know, a lot of other countries out there that have shown that you don't need to have hegemony to have security. But in fact, maybe the rest of the country of the world,
all countries,
right? But be that as it may, let's jump to the you call for Biden to resist NATO expansion. Let's roll that into China as well, because there was a story out today that in the Wall Street Journal talking about a report that was commissioned by the NATO Secretary General, that its focus should change to China. And certainly there are three data points I have on this and the whole turn to China. One is going back 20 years ago, Gary Hart, I interviewed shortly after, back in 2004, and he told a story. He sat on a committee about threats to United States. He, and I think it was maybe Rudman, chaired a 21st century U.S. security threat commission. On the first meeting, they went around the table with 20 people. What's their threat? All of them said, and this was in the summer of 2000, I think, non-state actors, essentially like Al-Qaeda. One person said China. Everybody laughed. They reconvened 3 or 4 months later. Same thing. China. That person never came back again. That person was Lynn Cheney. And then we have the pivot, which was both on a commercial side, the TPP to isolate China. And I was telling Emma, I got held over on a flight in LA. I went down to the USS Iowa, and walked in to look at where our bases were, our Pacific. And the guy working there said, that we had moved all of our naval operations to the Pacific in anticipation of trying to contain China. I was like, I didn't know that. He's, oh, yeah, yeah. And that's happened under the Obama administration. What's going on with our perspective on China? NATO's now attempting to get involved. Where should we be, and where should Joe Biden go, and where do you think we're headed?
That's very interesting about NATO, because Europe has been, and I think continues to be, quite divided on the China question. The United States under Trump has been pushing Europe to be more anti-China than some people have wanted to go. So we'll see about NATO. Is NATO fit for purpose to be a bulwark against China? Is a good question as a North Atlantic security organization, but it's always searching for a new purpose after the fall of the Soviet Union. So maybe this will give it something coherent to do. I'm really concerned about the tenor of U.S.-China relations. And we talked about the shift toward...
I mean, do we need a bulwark against China? I mean, in what way and why?
Well, look, China poses a number of challenges. It has been coercive in the use of economic diplomacy, particularly in its own region. Look at the way it punished Australia concerning Australia's objections to Chinese transparency vis-a-vis the virus. Mm-hmm. Its human rights abuses are terrible, no doubt about it, right? And we do have economic competition. But the military threat from China has been massively inflated by members of both political parties. I do not go to bed at night worried that China is going to attack this country.
Stephen, do you think that has to do with the economic competition, the desire to ramp up that kind of rhetoric in order to get the public behind more aggressive economic action, whatever that may be?
Yeah, I think that, voters who are anti-China, they're thinking of their jobs, their communities, and they're blaming China for that, or they're blaming deals that we've made, right? And that makes sense. But the people in Washington who are looking for, I'm afraid, a way to keep the defense budget healthy, which is to say more than half of our federal discretionary budget year after year, are using every objection against China, including legitimate objections, lumping that together with this sense of military threat. But, hardly anyone believes China is about to invade South Korea, Japan, Australia, the Philippines, U.S. allies. It has increased its military capabilities roughly in line with the growth of its economy over the past several decades. And what I really fear is that the United States just cannot say no to trying to be the dominant military power in the Indo-Pacific region. And it's just going to view any expansion of Chinese military capability as a threat to itself, when in fact that's maybe a threat to the U.S. ability to operate militarily, but not a threat to the United States or the vital interests of the American people. We actually have an opportunity right now with China to focus on the things that matter most to the American people and the planet: climate change, pandemic disease. These things call for more cooperation, not harsher confrontation. But, and we know also, I think we have a period of time, at least. It may be that China gets more aggressive in a military sense later on as it rises. That is possible. And that's a legitimate worry. But it's not about, it doesn't have the forces to, or the desire to go on some sort of military rampage. So we have time to take a step back, allow the countries, our partners, allies, and others in the region who are more threatened than we are by the possibility of future Chinese aggression, to judge these threats for themselves, spend more money on their military if they think the threat requires it, form coalitions to counterbalance China. We could play some role in facilitating those counterbalancing coalitions as well. But we have time. But I'm afraid that what most of the national security community wants to do is put ourselves on the front line, not prudently wait and assess the threat and let others take the initiative.
Is that simply just a function of, like, there's money to be made? I mean, I'm talking specifically in the massive military budget. I mean, it's harder now for me to sort of like wrap my head around the interplay between the military and the economics. Like, you know, like in the, you know, the 20th century, maybe the earlier part, and certainly the 19th century, I could see like, well, you need a Navy because you need your shipping lanes to be open. But where does that interplay exist now in the context of China? Like, why are we putting our ships, so many ships in the Pacific? I mean, I understand they got to go somewhere, and maybe they're just like, well, there's nowhere else to put them.
We got so many.
But we could also decommission a bunch of them, and we could do that. What is the interplay, if there is any? And I certainly, I think it's another episode of the program to talk about. Let's have our supply lines. Let's not be so contingent upon what's going on in China for our supply lines. Yeah, let's have some redundancy, et cetera, et cetera. But putting that aside, like what is even the justification for this other than to say, like, they're Chinese, they could be coming after us?
Well, there you go. That's the justification, basically. but I think there's no question that the concentrated interests, are a tremendous problem. It's why the massive military budgets are must-pass items in Congress year after year. I think the specter of competing with China also solves a problem if you want to keep this general U.S. role in the world going right now, because China is actually not so reckless in its use of military power. Not many people think that we're going to get into a war with China in the near term. So if you're looking at calls among the American public and even political leaders to, end endless war, a weariness of military intervention, well, here you've got an opponent that, we can spend a lot of money in the name of deterrence. And if there's going to be a conflict, we're kicking that can down the road. That's probably not going to happen for a while. Now, meanwhile, just as in the first Cold War, we may come back into the Middle East and fight proxy wars in the global South, which will be endless wars again. But, for now, it's a nice fantasy to imagine that we will discipline ourselves and engage in a more strategic competition, and deterrence will always work. The problem is that by, again, putting ourselves on the front line, we are eliminating the incentive for others to step up, judge threats for themselves. And, maybe ultimately China doesn't feel so threatened as a result. And there's greater peace and prosperity in that region and certainly in the United States.
So in other words, in some ways, China is a great boogeyman because they're never going to come out of the closet and actually attack us. And we can just, we can just generate a lot of cash for a certain group of people. And it's low, I guess, jeopardy, except for the fact that we're just burning all this cash. And who knows what happens when you make all these military machines, people want to use them.
Yeah, and we're, creating antagonism with the world's number two power. Meanwhile, the planet's burning. China's the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. We can have a Green New Deal at home and get our emissions down to zero. That will not solve the planetary problem of climate change. You need China. And China's been the number one developer of green technologies in many areas, including electric vehicles, solar panels. So if we were really concerned about, let's say, climate change, leaving aside pandemic disease as a national security threat, maybe that would be our priority instead of potentially creating military antagonisms between the world's number one and number two powers.
Well, Stephen Wertheim, from your mouth to Joe Biden's ears and those around him, thank you so much for joining us today. Folks should check out your book, Tomorrow the World. We will put a link to your book and to the piece in Foreign Policy at majority.fm. Thanks again.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Back in a moment. So, Bill Barr decided that there was really no way to salvage this Trump thing. I have a feeling that to a certain extent, he got word that this was starting to become a problem with Georgia, because this is also timed where Kelly Loeffler is apparently just gone nuts on Raphael Warnock in terms of like accusations and whatnot.
Warnock has a better chance,
indeed,
even than Ossoff. Warnock is more formidable and someone to look out for, even though he doesn't have the name recognition online as much.
That's right. Ossoff, of course, you know, was, I think, more well known because of his run in that special election 3 or 4 years ago. Here is how Fox evolved over the course of the day when it came to the question of Bill Barr announcing that the DOJ has no evidence of any type of fraud. And apparently he had spoken to the Department of Homeland Security. They had no evidence. Here's Andrew McCarthy on Fox News with Dana Perino.
And so far, we haven't seen anything to substantiate that. As I just getting this breaking news that caught my eye. So let me turn it over to you for some reaction.
Well, I think, Dana, this is kind of a common sense assertion by the attorney general, if you think about it, because, you know, the Trump campaign had federal lawsuits that they brought in both Pennsylvania and Michigan and dropped them. And in connection with the Pennsylvania suit, they expressly told the federal judge that they were not alleging fraud and actually pulled the fraud counts out. And I just point that out because it's much harder to make a criminal election fraud case than it is to make a civil election fraud case.
Oh.
So if they're unable to prove this up in a civil court, I don't know why anyone would be surprised that there's no evidence, at least at the moment, for a criminal case. You would think that they would have made more progress on the civil side if they had that kind of compelling evidence.
And the attorney general did take a step. I think it was.
There it is. Now, let's see how this evolved by end of day,
right,
a couple hours later on Fox Business News with Lou Dobbs.
Good evening, everybody. President Trump, his legal team, members of the Republican Party making advances today in the battle for the White House. There have been significant developments in six key battleground states, all of which,
not really,
all of which bolster President Trump's charge that there has been clear electoral fraud, fraud that nullified the will of the people in the November election. The president's progress puts him at odds with the insidious rhinos, radical Dems, corporate America, big tech, and the deep state, who have tried to overthrow his presidency for more than 4 years. Today, a member of his own cabinet appeared to join in with the radical Dems and the deep state and the resistance. Attorney General William Barr, who has been absent for weeks and weeks, telling the Associated Press that the U.S. attorneys and FBI agents who have followed up on complaints of specific voter fraud across the country have produced nothing. To date, we have not seen fraud on a scale, he said, that could have affected a different outcome in the election. For the Attorney General of the United States to make that statement, he is either a liar or a fool or both. He may be perhaps compromised. He may be simply unprincipled, or he may be personally distraught or ill. But in no way can he honestly stand up before the American people and say that the FBI has with any integrity or intensity investigated voter fraud in this country and then say it did not amount to anything. Because what we are hearing just from the eyewitnesses in state legislative hearings, forget all of the rest, those eyewitnesses in state legislative hearings across the country tell the truth. And it's a story of election fraud, elections rigged to deny the will of the majority in this country. And we will be taking that up here tonight.
There you go.
What do we even say?
There you go. The Bill Barr's distraught, ill, compromised,
and
joining with the
Democrats,
insidious rhino. Of course, in these states that he's talking about, they have certified the votes. They've certified the election. In some of those instances, you're talking about Republican officials who have certified it. It is the entire world against Donald Trump. And you would only think that Donald Trump would take in more than just 25% of that $170 million that he has raised, probably closer to $200 million at this point, and put all of it towards maintaining the will of the American public. But, you know, you got to put some away too.
He's got some debt.
All right. And that's it for us today. We will see you tomorrow. Unless, of course, you're sticking around for the fun half of the show.
Woohoo!
And when you do, well, you're going to hear us. We got a lot more sound to go through, a lot more stories. I want to talk about Section 230, too, which is Donald Trump is using its Section 230. Well, we'll talk about this in the fun half. But Section 230 is the part of the Digital Millennium Act, I think it is, that basically says websites are platforms as opposed to publishers.
Mm-hmm.
And so if commenters, or if you're a YouTube, you know, if someone uploads it to YouTube or someone comments in a YouTube thing and they libel somebody or in a YouTube show, I guess slander somebody, that YouTube is not responsible. Or if somebody goes to majority.fm was to leave comments that were slanderous, or I should say libel, I guess, they would be writing them, that I wouldn't be responsible.
Right.
It's a, in broad strokes, I am in favor of that, but it needs some tweaks because I do think it is a problem. And I think it has that immunity and that ability to classify themselves as platform versus a publisher has allowed them, some of these companies, to amass an enormous amount of influence,
mm-hmm,
and wealth and power. It also results in misinformation. I'm not sure we can ever stop misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
We've always had it. The problem with it now is its ability to overpower other information.
Exactly.
And, you know, like Alex Jones has been around for 25 years at least. And so we will talk more about that in the fun half, among other things that we will talk about. But let me just tell you this, folks, if you want to be a, join us in the fun half, become a member of the show, go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Become a member of the show. You can gift the show. Do we still have cucknation.org? Is it still? I should say, is it cucknation.com or cucknation.org?
Yes.
Speaking of
cucknation.org goes to tmbs.fm.
Oh, he changed it? That son of a bitch. Well, look at that. Well, all right. Well, we've got you can find at jointhemajorityreport.com. You can get, you can do a gifting situation for the show set up by Ronald Reagan back in the day, who sent us some apples. Did we talk about the apples? We thank
apples.
Ronald Reagan.
Thank you, Ronald Reagan.
Listener Ronald Reagan.
I had one yesterday. I was famished, in need of replenishment, and
they
gave it to me.
Well, we should talk about this in the fun half, how he addressed the box to here. That was pretty, and he ended up embarrassing himself more than anything else. But with that said, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You can gift a membership to people at jointhemajorityreport.com, and you can also buy some holiday swag. It looks very similar to our non-holiday swag, but you can go to shop.majorityreportradio.com. All of our swag is American-made, union-made, union-printed, right? Brendan, there was like one thing that we couldn't get, like...
Yeah, everything is union printed.
Everything's awesome. Union printed. Thank you, Brendan. And so check that out, shop.majorityreportradio.com. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And we'll see you in the, it's swag, not swag, Sammy. All right, sorry. All right, see you in the fun half.
In for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a bank. A hell of a bank. A hell of a bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, 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 pussy.